You might have heard a little earlier this week about a staff member at a Rockhampton aged care facility having pulmonary tuberculosis. Now, this isn't completely uncommon here in Queensland, but it did get our historian Helen Gregory thinking about how this disease has affected Queensland throughout our history. Good morning.
Good morning, Kate.
And it sounds like a disease through, with a great historical connection, TB, of course. But tell me a little bit about it.
Well, Kate, in the early 20th century, TB was the largest cause of death in females and second highest in males. So it really was a highly significant disease. The interesting thing is, if we go back a little bit further into the 19th century, when we see mention of TB in newspapers or other sources, it usually refers to TB in livestock. And of course, that is a significant problem, although we'll focus on the people today. I did notice in 1875 that one of the Rockhampton papers published a report that said sea bathing was contraindicated for tuberculosis.
So right.
There was obviously some awareness. And in 1881, there was a report of a 14-year-old boy's death from tuberculosis. Now, it had been known for some time. The German bacteriologist Robert Koch identified the bacillus which causes it in 1881 and announced to the world in 1882 and published a big article. So that's 1882, but conquering the disease took a lot longer than that. And it was known that TB was infectious. And in the 19th century, patients often from the Brisbane area would be sent to the Dunwich Benevolent Place on North Stradbroke Island, where they could be isolated while they had TB. And the disease was also known as consumption. And I think it's because, to be really severely affected by the disease, it eventually sort of consumes the whole body. Now, most of my knowledge is about TB of the lungs, but it can affect the bones as well. So it's a pretty horrible thing. And many people came to Queensland if they had TB because it was thought that warm weather helped to cure it. And the main treatments were rest, sunlight, good food and fresh air. And that's for people with early infection where it looked as though they might recover. And in Brisbane, the former Diamantina Orphanage at South Brisbane was converted into a hospital for chronic diseases, and two open-air wards were constructed so that the TB patients could have sunlight, fresh air and so forth. And the matron of that organisation when it opened in 1900 was Florence Chatfield, and she also a little later served as superintendent there, and she was a nurse from the Brisbane General Hospital where she became deputy matron. So she was highly experienced to take over this responsibility for this serious disease. But patients that had more serious and more advanced disease needed much more intensive nursing. And of course, they had to be isolated to prevent the spread of the disease. And so from the mid-19th to the mid-20th century, sanatoria loomed large in the popular consciousness. Everybody seemed to know someone who had to go to the sanatorium because they had TB. And that was true in most parts of the world. And there were several places like that in Queensland. And when you think about it, running these specialist organisations, these sanatoria, was quite a big ask for a health system that was struggling to cope with ordinary illness in the population. And it was also a bit hard on the nursing and medical staff because they're often in very isolated places.
Moira in Brisbane. Good morning, Moira.
Good morning.
So tell me about your auntie.
Yes, my auntie Pauline Beswick, she was a nursing sister at the Royal Brisbane Hospital in those days. In 1945, she contracted tuberculosis from nursing the soldiers coming back from war. And she got it badly, and the doctors had never done surgery or anything like that before, but they said to my grandmother, her mother, they said, let us operate on her because she will die, so let us operate on her. And so Grandma agreed. I mean, I can't believe that because Auntie Pauline was 30, you know, or more. But at any rate, they went ahead with the operation and they removed 1 1/4 lungs. Now, Auntie Pauline recovered and she went on to become the head nurse and ran the outpatients department at the Royal Brisbane Hospital for the next 13 years before she died.
Amazing, on 3/4 of a lung.
Goodness, that is extraordinary, Moira. And we are getting to the incidence of tuberculosis in returned soldiers a little bit later because it really was significant. So that's a very interesting recollection.
Yes, yes. It was a big story in our family, of course, you know, because she recovered.
Yes, and that would change the way they approached the disease from then on, I would imagine.
Yes, she was just wonderful, you know, to go on and run the outpatients department, you know.
But you're right. What a call from your mum at the time. We haven't done this before. Yes. She's going to die anyway. Let's have a shot. Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Moira. Appreciate that call. Wonderful.
Thank you very much.
So you were talking, Helen Gregory, about the sanatoria that had been opened up in regional places. How else was the care approached?
Well, one of the most interesting was the sanatorium at Dalby, and it was known as the Jubilee Sanatorium. It was opened in 1900, and there were a number of Jubilee sanatorium around the world, and they were set up by the Queen Victoria Homes for Consumptives Fund, which was initiated in 1897. And so that was a particularly interesting one because it was part of the broader pattern. But the Kyoomba Sanatorium, about 10 kilometres from Stanthorpe, is another important example. And that was funded by Margaret Allison, who was a very tenacious, wealthy and well-respected Scottish migrant. And she was the original benefactor. And Deborah Wheeler has written a really interesting history of the Kyoomba Sanatorium. And we often think of the Spanish flu as the disease that affected soldiers returning from the First World War, but TB was really significant. And so Margaret Allison saw a need to treat the soldiers, and she freely chose to make the sanatorium available to the Red Cross, and it ran as a sanatorium between 1916 and 1925. And at Westwood, near Rockhampton, there was another sanatorium which opened in 1919, and it was such a big event that two special trains came from Rockhampton for the grand opening. But it was initially opened to treat miners who were suffering from that ghastly lung disease, which sadly has had a resurgence recently. But gradually the miners' lung disease declined in its incidence and tuberculosis was rising. So Westwood became a sanatorium. But by the 1940s, drugs had been developed which could treat some cases, obviously not Moira's aunt, but so the remaining patients from the Westwood Sanatorium were taken to the chest clinic at the Rockhampton General Hospital, and Westwood became a nursing home, but it's since been demolished. And the good old Diamantina, one of the earliest places, also outlived its purpose as cases of tuberculosis declined, and the old buildings fell into disrepair. And in 1956, a new 600-bed hospital was built on the land, and of course that became the Princess Alexandra Hospital. But as Moira pointed out, after the Second World War, there was a high incidence of TB in returned soldiers.
Once again.
Mm. Yep, once again. And an entirely new sanatorium was built in Pullenvale in 1944. When it was constructed, it was known as the Kenmore Sanatorium, although we'd probably now call it Pullenvale. And it was set up by the Allied Works Council, and they noted that it was situated on a pleasant ridge which commands delightful and expansive views, again, plenty of fresh air, and fairly isolated. And there were 32 patients in 1, 2 or 4 bed wards. It was opened in 1945, but then it became a general repatriation hospital and is now the Fairview War Veterans Home for Aged People. Mm. So, it again, there was this rotation of the sites. So how did we conquer TB? Because clearly, even though there was that case in Rockhampton recently, it's not well known in the population now. But the federal government became so worried about the death rate from TB that in 1925 they had a royal commission and set up a tuberculosis campaign. And it was a very important campaign to try to wipe the disease out because it was recognised as a disease of national significance. But along came the Depression, that slowed the plan. Then the Second World War, that slowed it again. And we're hoping that there'll be a vaccine against COVID-19 that's effective, but there was one for TB. It's known as BCG, for Bacillus Calmette-Guérin, and it's a weakened form of the bacteria. But it was developed over a period of 13 years, from 1908 to 1921. So that's nearly 40 years after Koch discovered the germ. Mm. So it did take quite a long time.
And obviously it couldn't have been everywhere, or there wouldn't have been the waves of people coming back from, you know, from war with it.
And that's right, exactly. And I think some of our listeners will remember the post-war TB campaigns. And in 1948, the vaccine was available in Australia, but for healthcare workers, Aboriginal people and people in close contact of active cases. Where have we heard all that before? But in the 1950s, all Australian school children, except those in New South Wales and the Australian Capital Territory, were required to have what was known as a Mantoux test. And that was a strange device. It had a little circle with pins, and that put in the under the skin of the forearm a little bit of what was known as PPD tuberculin. And if where that insert site became raised, that meant the child either had TB or had been exposed to it. So chest x-rays often followed. Those who had no reaction had to be immunised.
Bev, I should say, from Atherton, that's sounding familiar to you, I bet?
Well, that sounds very familiar, because that's what I was sort of ringing about. I'm from Atherton in Far North Queensland, but I sort of was wondering, because there was a guy in our town who had TB, and, well, we thought he had TB, and he was a returned soldier, and I thought that might have instigated it, but it doesn't sound like that. It sounds like it was a regular thing, because we all had to have this TB test, and like
Helen?
What's the name?
Helen?
Sorry. Helen yep. was saying, it was a circular thing, and if the puncture marks raised, you were considered positive, and which mine did sort of raise, or half raised or something. So then they had an x-ray van where you had to go afterwards and have an x-ray to see. And then they must have decided that there wasn't anything for me to worry about, but they found something strange with my heart. So they sent me off to the hospital to have that checked out. But that's the experience that we had with TB, and that's what Helen would have been talking about just
yes.
then.
And did that all just sound totally normal to you at the time? It wasn't a big deal, or was it a sort of scary thing?
It wasn't a big deal, because, you know, as kids, I don't know, I might have been 12 at the time or 13. You just take those things as a matter of course. You didn't get around and think it was anything scary or anything like that. And I don't ever remember my mother or thinking it was anything scary. As a matter of fact, I think when it came to the time to go off to the hospital to check out the irregularity with the x-ray I had with my heart part, I don't think she even came with me. But I'm not sure about that one. Yeah.
Bev, anyway. thank you so much. Good to hear that, because, when Helen gathers these pieces of information from old newspaper articles and all sorts of different places, and it's really great to hear from people who lived it as well.
Yeah,
so thank you for the call.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
And of course, even with the immunisation, TB didn't die out immediately, and the Brisbane Chest Hospital was opened in 1954 to treat people with tuberculosis. But By the time prevention and treatment had improved, that hospital began to take patients with a wider variety of illnesses. It became the Chermside Hospital in 1961, and now, of course, it's the Prince Charles Hospital. So a lot of, and there was a chest clinic in George Street, and the vans that took x-rays that our caller mentioned trundled around until well into the 1970s. So it was a great, and of course, it's still a notifiable disease. So, but I think, like all infectious diseases, it's a case of we must always be vigilant.
Ingrid, how old were you when you had TB?
I was diagnosed at the age of 3, which was in 1950. My parents migrated out from Europe, and we were taken to a hostel in Parkes, and that's where I fell. And I actually contracted it in the hip from a fall. A doctor many years later said that it may have been caused from unpasteurised milk that some kind neighbour gave my mother sort of for her young baby. And so I was brought from Parkes down to Sydney to the Royal Alexandra Hospital for Children. And I was in convalescent for 7.5 years consecutively at coming back from their place out at Collaroy, and then they would take you back to Sydney. And as a result, my right leg, because it was in the hip, and I wore braces and calipers, and I was in plaster, and I was on a frame. My right leg was 4.5 inches shorter. And in those days, the doctor that I had, he was not an orthopaedic surgeon. He was just an orthopaedic doctor. And then when he retired, I was under the care of a wonderful Canadian orthopaedic surgeon. And he suggested that I have my hip fused and also my leg lengthened.
And, So I'm just thinking, you were 3 when you were first diagnosed. And you're talking
3.5 years.
3. So you were 11 years old by the time you were out of hospital and all of that.
That's correct.
And Ingrid, so I'm so glad you called, because I think about tuberculosis as being a lung issue, as you mentioned before, Helen. But that's not necessarily just the case, is it?
Oh no, it can be in the bones and in other organs. We tend to think of it most commonly as a lung disease, but that's, and therefore the association with milk is interesting too.
Thank you so much for your call, Ingrid. I appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Wonderful to very interesting to hear that. Not wonderful, I should clarify. That was a terrible, terrible thing to have happened to Ingrid, but very interesting to be able to get that real different take on what this disease can do. But Leonie in Atherton, g'day.
Hello, Kate and Helen. I really enjoy your show each week. It takes me back quite a bit. I grew up in Sandgate. My father was a veteran, and he developed tuberculosis and was put into the Kenmore Sanitarium around late 1958-59. It seems he was there for almost a couple of years, and I had that skin test, and so did my brother, and the x-rays and the vaccines, etc. And I actually thought it was quite romantic. My grandmother had to speak sternly to me when I found out what my father's illness was this time, because he'd been in and out of Greenslopes Veterans Hospital for many, many visits with the ulcers and things, but I thought tuberculosis was so romantic because all the Brontes had had it, you see. I was excited to tell people, and my grandmother said, no, you don't tell anyone that your father has TB. Apparently it was a shameful thing as far as she was concerned. But the drama was, it was a beautiful place actually out there in those days, but we lived at Brighton, and of course my mother didn't drive, and so my little brother and my mother and I used to catch the bus from Sandgate into Eagle Street in Brisbane, and then make our way to North Quay, and then another bus to Kenmore. It was quite a journey every week. And that went on for quite, you know, for that period of time.
And what were the visits like? Because, you know, in the COVID frame, we're thinking about isolation. I think the idea of the sanatoria was to keep people basically out of the way so they're not mixing too much. But then
we didn't go into the wards the way you did at Greenslopes. At Greenslopes, there was one ward the kiddies couldn't go into, and that was a chest ward, we were told. But Dad used to come out and sit with us somewhere. So it was sort of like a prison visit, I suppose. Yes. And
was his the lung one, or was it something else?
Yes, right. This was lung. And one of his close friends, they were frequent customers at the Osborne Hotel at Shorncliffe, he had developed it first. So the theory was that it sort of possibly came from glasses, you know, drinking glasses.
Well, it's interesting. Knows? There's a few different theories, Leonie. I'm just going to go now to David too, because you wanted to remind us, David, about the different theories about where you could get it from. G'day, Dave.
G'day, how are you? Yes, I remember that you could not have any cracked crockery, any cups or plates or anything of that nature, because it was thought that TB would actually get into the cracks and it could be passed on through somebody else using that crockery. So basically any cracked crockery at the time was destroyed. And also the Queensland government at the time had white timber plaques made up for butchers and places like that, with black black hand painted writing pointing out that with regard to the law, that it was, I think it was £50, or it was some outrageous amount at the time for expirating in public. It was forbidden to spit in public, with this huge fine if you did so. And that was to discourage the, passing the germ through spit.
Right. Okay. So some great points there. That fits with what you've seen, does it, Helen? The idea of fines and also the crockery thing. Have you seen that in your
I haven't seen
research?
The crockery thing. I've certainly seen that thing about the fines, because when you think about it, someone who spits is not just getting rid of some liquid matter, but, of course, droplets can spread. Now, whether I don't know enough about it to know whether it's transmissible by those droplets, but, of course, probably in these COVID times, it's the sort of thing that we have been warned against again.
That's true. Well, thank you so much for taking us on a trip back through history. Was there anything else you wanted to mention before you head off today, Helen?
No, Kate, but it's just interesting to know that it is still with us. And, of course, there is concern about antibiotic-resistant TB that may come in from New Guinea. So we, like all infections, we've just got to keep our eyes open and our wits about us, I think.
Yes. Now more than ever, that makes total sense. Helen Gregory, Queensland historian, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kate.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.